From WNYC in New York, this is NPR's On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. Well, it's been an eventful week for network television, beginning with the fallout on Capitol Hill over the Super Bowl halftime show. Mel Karmazin, president of CBS parent Viacom, found himself before a House committee testifying about his own network's shock and surprise over Janet Jackson's breakaway brassiere.
Nobody at CBS, nobody at Viacom, nobody at MTV, and certainly nobody at the NFL knew what was going to happen.
But nobody on the House Telecommunications Subcommittee was buying it. New Mexico Republican Heather Wilson.
You knew what you were doing. You knew what kind of entertainment you're selling. And you wanted us all to be abuzz here in this room and on the playground in my kid's school because it improves your ratings. It improves your market share, and it lines your pockets.
Disgusted with a broadcast culture that continues to define deviancy down, California Republican Christopher Cox suggested making broadcast television a raunch-free zone.
I will defend to my last breath your right to cuss and use foul language and run around naked with forest animals, if that's what suits you. But don't impose it on people who don't want it or on our kids who may want it but who deserve far better.
For the moment, the regulation of content appears to be little more than an idle threat to the networks, whose immediate punishment seems to be limited to an FCC fine. A more compelling threat, however, may not be from the government at all. Last week, the Walt Disney Company, owner of ABC, ESPN, and many other media properties, found itself under assault from another media corporation, the cable giant Comcast. The Philadelphia-based company, which commands more than 20 million cable subscribers, launched a $54 billion attempted buyout of Disney, raising the specter of still more media consolidation. Joining us now to discuss the implications of the Comcast bid is George Manis, senior editor of TheStreet.com. George, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me, Bob.
How is Wall Street regarding this proposal so far? Enthusiasm? Something less than enthusiasm?
There's almost unmitigated enthusiasm from Wall Street. The first thing that happened, it happens a lot in takeover deals. Comcast stock went down. Disney's stock went up. In fact, up so high that it hints that people are hopeful, as people are, that Comcast will raise its bid for Disney. And from an operational point of view, if you look at all the analysts' reports, they all say, you know, this is a pretty good idea.
Because Comcast has the distribution channels with more than 20 million cable subscribers, and Disney has the production facilities and the programming.
Right. What they talk about is Disney's content and Comcast distribution, which other people used to call vertical integration, but that's no longer fashionable.
Well, I want to ask you about that, because you would think that this possibility of the ultimate vertical integration in the entertainment business, in the media business, would send off all kinds of warning bells in Washington and among public interest advocates who believe that this further media consolidation will limit the choices that viewers have down the line. Are those alarm bells going off?
Fast and furious. People are up in arms about this. Concentration of media has become a hot button, as we saw last year when there was a huge popular uproar over the FCC's attempt to increase the number of broadcast stations an individual company could own. People are similarly worried about Comcast. This will be the world's largest media and entertainment company if this deal goes through, surpassing Time Warner, which is up there with Viacom or the biggest.
According to some reports that I've read, one of the reasons Comcast got interested in this deal is they had been trying with another partner, reportedly Cox, to come up with a competitor for ESPN, which is owned by Disney. They were frustrated with the fees that they, as owners of cable systems, were having to pay Disney for ESPN programming and were thinking about starting a competitive channel. Failing that, they are going after the owners of ESPN, and clearly, if they take over Disney, are not going to bother to create a competitive channel, which means less sports choice for viewers. Isn't this pretty much the essence of why the Cassandras are saying the sky is falling?
I don't know that it's anti-consumer in the classical sense that, let's say, prices will be raised. It is certainly anti-consumer in the way that you put it, that the number of choices will probably diminish. If you want to launch a new cable channel, it's going to be really easy to do it if you're Comcast. It's going to be a little harder to do it if you're not Comcast, and you have to ask Comcast for permission to get on their cable systems. And what Comcast might do here is what people like John Malone did in the 1980s and 1990s, which was to say, sure, you can get on my system, but I certainly would like a ownership stake in your channel.
Some months ago, Michael Eisner and Disney were in some trouble. Things have stabilized somewhat. The stock price is up. And in fact, Comcast, it appears, is willing to pay essentially retail for the Disney asset. Do you think that presages other takeover attempts of other very large media companies, like Viacom, for example, by others with distribution who want to merge distribution and content?
A deal similar to what is being discussed here just took place when Rupert Murdoch gained control of DirecTV, the satellite broadcaster in the United States. That was marrying content with distribution on a big scale, but a smaller scale than this. NBC is probably going to merge with Vivendi Universal Entertainment, so it's going to keep going. It'll leapfrog.
Okay, George. Well, as they say, when you dial Disney, have a magical day.
Thank you, Bob.
George Manis is a senior writer for TheStreet.com. The White House released 18 months of President Bush's National Guard payroll records on Tuesday in an attempt to clear up the confusion surrounding the president's service in the Guard during the Vietnam War. But the records didn't clear everything up. In fact, they fueled a firestorm that raged through the press room and left Press Secretary Scott McClellan nursing singed eyebrows. The press briefing began innocuously enough. McClellan outlined a meeting the president had just wrapped up with some economic leaders, and then he invited questions from the reporters.
The president's position that these documents put this issue to rest, period.
Oh, I think these documents show that he fulfilled his duties. These documents show that he met his requirements.
Okay, case closed, right? Well, no. Not really.
I know it's the second time you've asked this question.
Right, and I'll ask you to maybe get some.
The White House press corps is not normally known for its esprit de corps, but very occasionally, like a flock of migrating birds, they find themselves flying in formation. Determined to arrive at some straight answers on Tuesday, they for once acted in concert instead of flying solo.
Can you just clarify back to Elizabeth's question here on document 5, for example?
Mike.
Scott, Mary asked Dana's question. You keep saying he served.
40 minutes in, McClellan had finally had enough.
We're going to keep moving. Any more on this topic? Do you have this topic? Then Wendell is a new subject. We're off this topic.
Bill Plant is a veteran of the press corps and a participant in Tuesday's briefing, and he joins me now from Washington. Bill, welcome back to the show.
Thank you, Bob.
When we last spoke to you, it was last March, before the war, and following a press conference with the president in which the press corps was particularly quiescent and failed to follow up on many a legitimate question that the president seemed to have dodged. What's changed since March of 2003?
There's a subtext in every daily briefing and in all presidential news conferences, and it has to do with the expectations of the reporters about what will actually get answered. There was no expectation in that news conference a year ago that the president would answer the questions which he was asked about going to war. You simply don't press harder because you are relatively certain that you won't get more. Now, I'm not saying that that's something to be admired. I'm simply suggesting that it is a fact of life around here in almost any administration. You develop a sense for where a spokesperson is likely to go on any given subject because you kind of know what their parameters are and what their answers are likely to be.
Let me ask you a question about license. In the past 6 months, the candidates for the Democratic presidential nomination have been relentless in their criticism of the White House. And a week ago on Meet the Press, Tim Russert was equally relentless in questioning the president about policy and the war and so forth. Has the White House press corps suddenly been liberated, given license to be harder on the president than it hitherto had been?
I think that when a story reaches a certain critical mass, people do feel more licensed to jump in with both feet.
Well, I'm curious about this sort of central nervous system of the press corps. Should it be sensitive to the outside environment and whether a story has achieved critical mass, or should it never be timid and always be aggressive and never mind what the surrounding environment might be?
In a perfect world, it should always be aggressive. But what happens, of course, is that people learn very quickly that if they press too hard, they simply get shut off. And they get shut off only for the day. I've never known, well, hardly ever known anybody to get really shut off. But you learn quickly that you can't get anywhere, so you don't try as hard. Is this ideal? Absolutely not. But it's also true that if everybody came in here every day with guns blazing and insisted and demanded and whatnot, very little more would be accomplished than already is. Because I think one of the critical things to understanding the daily public briefings at the White House is that they are not where most of the real business gets done, because the nuanced material is not something that the White House is usually willing to put out on the record. And reporters know that. That just is a sort of way that business is done.
Now, this may just be my imagination speaking, but at some point in this briefing, it seemed to me that it ceased to matter whether McClellan was being responsive or not, and that there was a sort of shark attack going on, that the sharks smelled blood and were just chomping away willy-nilly. Was I just saying things?
It would be wrong of me to suggest that any of my colleagues might be attracted by the opportunity to gang up on the spokesman just because they're frustrated on a daily basis. But human nature being what it is, there might be something to that.
Were there high fives afterwards? Any kind of sort of mutual acknowledgement of what had taken place?
Just a lot of rueful chuckling. The day after that, Mr. McClellan came up with a new phrase. We were trolling for dirt, emptying out the garbage. Usually happens much later in campaigns, he said. We're just so sorry that it's happened so soon in this one.
Okay. Well, Bill, safe trolling.
Thank you, Bob.
Bill Plant is the White House correspondent for CBS News.
Coming up, no sunshine in the Sunshine State, and when presidents attack.
This is On the Media from NPR. This is On the Media. I'm Bob Garfield.
And I'm Brooke Gladstone. As we just heard, the White House press corps may be clamoring for information, but the White House is showing even less willingness to give it up. Recently, the National Press Club wrote Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld a letter protesting broad new restrictions on what may be posted on the Defense Department Inspector General's website. The Defense Department Inspector General's website? Well, that may not mean much to us, but it means a heck of a lot to Pentagon reporters like John Donnelly, who's chairman of the board of the National Press Club.
The Inspector General is one of the few organizations that has the authority to look into Defense Department programs and produces publicly available documents about what it finds. I regularly write about, for example, contractors overcharging on spare parts and the like. One time I did a report on an Inspector General document indicating that Pentagon weapons systems overseas were causing garage doors to open and close and baby monitors to go off. So it's everything from the arcane to the more significant things about the major weapon systems sometimes costing more than they say they're going to, or not performing as well as advertised.
So the way I understand it, there wasn't any formal announcement made about the change and what kind of information would be available on the site. How did you learn about it?
Well, I was just happened to be on the site, as I sometimes am, looking for something else, and I came across this December 5th memo from the Inspector General, Joseph Schmitz, laying out various categories of information that would not be put on the website. Now, the Inspector General's people tell me that the intention was not to restrict the flow of information, but actually to increase it, and that these were merely guidelines telling people sort of how to go about increasing it. I don't know what their intentions are, but if you look at the language of the memo itself, it is worded so broadly that it could definitely be construed to be more restrictive with information than they typically are.
I did look at the language of the memo, and it said that among the restricted information would be information not specifically approved for public release, information that would pose an unacceptable risk to national security or threaten the safety and privacy of men and women in the armed forces, and most worrisome, at least to me, information of questionable value to the general public. Now, who would determine that?
Well, who would determine any of these is a good question. This report about the baby beepers going off in Germany because of our weapon systems, who's to say that that is not going to be deemed by someone to pose a risk to national security? A lot of the information on the Inspector General's website is not of interest to the general public, but it is of value to the general public. In other words, it takes reporters to actually present it to the public in a way that they understand. And then the other categories of information they would restrict, such as information that might threaten the safety and privacy of the people in uniform, or information that's not approved for public release, they seem to be redundant to me to the extent that we already have protections in place. And the risk of having this additional wording is that it's worded so broadly that you might go beyond what the current restrictions are on classified and other kinds of protected information.
Do you have any way of knowing if the change has been implemented?
Oh, it's been implemented because the memo says effective immediately. If the question is, do I know of information taken off the website as a result of the policy, the answer is no.
You wouldn't know that.
Exactly. Unless I had a source who would tell me that something's been removed or not put on to begin with because of this new policy.
Now, the National Press Club, and you're the chairman of the NPC board, wrote a letter to Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld protesting the Inspector General's new policy. Have you gotten any reply?
Nope, we have not. Not even a thank you for your interest in national defense reply. So we may have to follow up with him and see if he received the first one.
Well, John, thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
John Donnelly is a reporter for Congressional Quarterly and chairman of the board of the National Press Club. Federal agencies are not alone in being unresponsive to secrecy concerns. That attitude has filtered down. Case in point, Florida, the Sunshine State, aptly named not just for its weather, but for laws that guarantee Floridians open access to public records. Trouble is, those laws are often ignored, or so found the Sarasota Herald Tribune. The paper helped to organize a kind of sting operation and found that the state was mostly not in compliance with its own access laws. Reporter Matthew Doig was involved in the undercover audit. Matthew, welcome to On the Media.
Thanks for having me.
So first of all, what prompted this project?
For about the past year or so, my colleague Chris Davis and I have been doing a number of stories that required public records, and we kept coming across people who were, you know, putting up these roadblocks and not giving us things that were clearly a public record. And for a while now, we've been saying, you know, one of these days we should do an audit, and we finally got to the point where we were sick of the roadblocks and said, okay, we're going to do it.
And you were testing the public records law. What
right.
does that law say?
It says basically that any person can get a public record, which is basically any record generated by government.
So reporters from your paper and other news outlets went throughout the state undercover, and what were their marching orders?
To go out, be polite, but pose as basically regular citizens and see what happened when they asked for something that is clearly a public record.
And they were supposed to remain anonymous.
Right. the law gives you anonymity, because if you're asking for sensitive information and you don't want any kind of reprisals or anything, you may not want to give your name, and the law says you don't have to.
So your volunteers visited some 234 different local agencies in almost all of the state's counties, and in the end, only 57% of the agencies were in compliance with the public records law.
Right.
Give me some anecdotes about what your volunteers confronted.
The notable case is the one at the Charlotte County School District. A volunteer went in and asked for the superintendent's cell phone bill. And while they were back looking for it, two sheriff's deputies showed up. It was clearly the fact that somebody was coming up and for the first time asking for the superintendent's cell phone bill that kind of made everybody uneasy. The volunteer who went to Broward County, there was a county administrator. He asked for the week's worth of emails, and the guy made kind of thinly veiled threats, said, "I can make your life very difficult," required that person give a name. After he got the person's name, he found the phone number, called the volunteer up, and left a message saying, essentially, "Look, I can find you. You know, I don't know what you're doing." And he also called where the volunteer worked and was trying to find out what that person was doing, looking into his background.
Does it surprise you that people would get suspicious when anonymous people come in asking for officials' cell phone records?
Well, I mean, I don't know if surprise is the right word. I think there was a instinct out there among these people that they were very nervous. You know, they wondered if they were being investigated or if a political opponent had pushed this along. The feeling out there was not, well, this person wants a document and it's a public record, so I'm going to get it to him as fast as possible. It was, oh my goodness, how am I going to protect myself from whatever they want to get on me?
Was September 11th ever used as a justification for denying the public records requests?
Absolutely. There was this September 11th boogeyman out there that was cited often. You know, another, and I hate to pick on the school superintendents, but another person went to a school superintendent and asked for a bill, and when we called him afterwards, I asked him why he didn't give it up, and he said, well, you know, the guy didn't give me his name, and for all I know, he could have been a terrorist.
A terrorist that wanted cell phone records?
Well, that's the question I posed to him. The thing he said was, you know, we've got children to protect, but, you know, he couldn't explain how a terrorist would use a cell phone bill to harm children.
You know, one of the stranger aspects of your audit was the fact that despite the dismal showing of the state of Florida, Florida actually has a pretty strong tradition of ensuring that access to public records is open.
Right. Well, the law's been around since 1909. It's one of the few states that have it written into the Constitution. And every time you turn on the news channels, you know, if there's a big kind of media bonanza in Florida, you'll always see the talking heads say, you know, thanks to Florida's generous public records laws, we got this document so quick. And that was kind of the point of the story, is that if you're a reporter or an attorney, even if you have to jump through some hoops, you're going to get what you want eventually, because the law is pretty clear. And that's why we set this up in a way where it was just a regular person without the power of the press or an attorney with them to test how they'd be treated.
Matthew Doig, thank you very much.
Thanks for having me.
Matthew Doig is a reporter for the Sarasota Herald Tribune.
The oldest Russian language paper in the United States has a new owner, one with a decidedly shady reputation. Vadim Rabinovich may be involved in organized crime and gun running, and he can't even get into America to see his latest acquisition. Reporter Fred Mogul has more.
Thank you.
I got to buy the 5 cents. Now I owe you 2 cents.
No problem.
Just
on a newspaper rack outside the Brighton Beach grocery, Novaya Ruskaya Slova, the new Russian word, sits sadly on a shelf, folded in half to take up less space. Immigrants pick up this country's only daily Russian-language newspaper on their way to the elevated train above the store, although fewer and fewer people are buying it these days. Sales clerk Hussein Muthan says the older readers outnumber younger ones.
The young people, they don't care. You read, like, English paper or something. They don't care for it. But the old people, like, from, like, 40 years and over, people buy Russian paper.
Novaya Ruskaya Slova once had literary and journalistic prestige, but the 93-year-old newspaper has languished. A recent issue was printed so badly that a front-page photo of its new owner, Vadim Rabinovich, was offset and blurry. Rabinovich himself has something of a hazy record, having emerged from a Soviet prison in the early 1990s just as a sort of Wild West capitalism was taking off. But Rabinovich says he profited from the chaos, not the corruption.
About 3% of the people got very rich, and 97% became very poor. Of those who got rich, many did so in dubious ways, though not necessarily illegally. Many people try to connect me with those others, because they don't understand what we do.
Rabinovich says he started several enterprises, including a paging network, discount cards, and a television station partly acquired by American cosmetics mogul Ronald Lauder. He has also been investigated by American and international law enforcement for illegal arms trafficking to Iran, North Korea, and Liberia. In the Frontline documentary Gunrunners, producer Eric Young found what he believes are persuasive links between Rabinovich and at least one illicit weapons shipment from Ukraine to Liberia.
We have sources that told us, we had intelligence files that were identifying him as being involved in organized crime activities, and we certainly had him associating with other people that were involved, according to intelligence files, involved in organized crime activities.
German author Jürgen Root has written a book about Rabinovich and reported extensively on the Russian and Ukrainian mafia. Root originally thought his Rabinovich project would be a portrait of an organized crime kingpin, but Root came to believe his subject is a legitimate entrepreneur.
I'm sure that there is no real evidence against Mr. Rabinovich, that he is a businessman as every businessman in the former Soviet Union, which at the beginning of his career has contacts to criminal structure.
Rabinovich has never been charged with criminal activity. The U.S. State Department has said it revoked his travel visa in 1995, but won't say why. Rabinovich denies he can't get a U.S. visa, although he still has yet to visit the New York headquarters of the newspaper he recently purchased.
The owner of Novaya Ruskaya Slova visited me several times, and I was able to look at the paperwork. But there's nothing for me to see there that I can't see from here.
Rabinovich wants to transform the 16-page Novaya Ruskaya Slova into something he hopes will look and function like a Russian-language Financial Times, not just in New York, but around the world. In fact, he licenses the FT for his new paper and his other ones in Ukraine and Israel. Ukrainian media watcher Natalia Ligachova says the British news content improves Rabinovich's papers, but also highlights how bad they are.
These productions are like hybrids. Yellow journalism produced by Rabinovich's writers and production staff, and high-quality news from the Financial Times. Important, influential people and decision-makers don't take these papers seriously.
Observers say that in addition to seeking profits, Rabinovich probably is expanding to the U.S. to try to bolster his political standing at home and abroad. He once fell out of favor with Ukraine's mercurial president, Leonid Kuchma, and moved his family to Israel. Now he's back in Kiev, publishing and broadcasting freely. Evidence, his critics say, of his cozying up to a government known to harass and censor the media. Again, Natalia Ligachova.
He belongs to the pro-presidential political forces. The president can control and influence him, and his newspapers very often use all sorts of spin that you wouldn't see in quality publications.
Larisa Mudrok, the new editor-in-chief of Novaya Ruskaya Slova and other Rabinovich publications, says her boss stakes out a position between the official and opposition press in the Ukraine and wants their reporters here in the U.S. to be neutral.
I've conferred with him, and he's given us the ability to operate as independent journalists, to take both sides in any situation, whether politics or anything else. So if we write about the positions of Democrats, we must also get Republicans at the same time.
Mudrok says she and Rabinovich are out to make money, not curry favor with the Kuchma government. It's not clear if Novaya Ruskaya Slova will help Rabinovich bring dollars or political currency back to Kiev, but he has already harvested at least one thing from his new New York newspaper. Jobs. 10 Manhattan-based page designers were fired, and their positions were moved to Ukraine, where labor is cheap. For On the Media, I'm Fred Mogul.
Well, this has to be a first. We are all too familiar with attacks by a challenger desperate to dislodge an entrenched incumbent. And we're almost as accustomed to attacks by an incumbent desperate to fend off a surging challenger. Lately, we've even heard a lot of attacks from would-be Democratic nominees, not against one another, but against the Republican incumbent they'd all like to challenge. But the first ad from the Bush-Cheney re-election campaign must break some sort of record.
John Kerry.
I have a message for the influence peddlers and the special interests. We're coming. You're going.
Sounds good. Special interests. More special interest money than any other senator? How much?
Whew. Yes, an attack ad from the President of the United States 9 months before the election, attempting to discredit a potential opponent only 3.5 weeks into the primary season. So far, it's only on the campaign website, but it surely doesn't bode well for the tenor of political discourse between now and November.
Facts. Kerry. Brought to you by the special interests. Millions from executives at HMOs, telecoms, drug companies. Ka-ching. Unprincipled?
I have a message for the influence peddlers and the special interests. And the special interests. The special interests.
Okay, the Willie Horton smear, it isn't. And no doubt the accusation of John Kerry's hypocrisy will raise questions about the sources of Bush's own $150 million war chest. But why this and why now? Historically, the initial campaign video recaps a president's own heroic successes in office and reaffirms his commitment to God, family, democracy, prosperity, peace, security, law, order, and free twisty bread with every pizza, as opposed to early bird character assassination. Yet this episode does adhere to a certain internal logic. Perhaps it represents the articulation of the Bush Doctrine Part 2, preemptive political warfare.
Up next, another made-for-TV murder, the Indian Theater of War, and FaceTime in Afghanistan.
This is On the Media from NPR.
Support for NPR comes from this and other NPR member stations and the Kresge Foundation, building the capacity of non-profit organizations through challenge grants since 1924, on the web at kresge.org. The Kellogg Foundation, helping people help themselves by investing in individuals, their families, and their communities, on the web at www.wkkf.org. And the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, making grants to improve the health and healthcare of all Americans, on the web at rwjf.org. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield. This Friday, for your viewing pleasure, the USA Cable Network offered The Perfect Husband, the Lacey Peterson story, starring erstwhile TV Superman Dean Cain as Scott Peterson, now awaiting trial for the murder of his pregnant wife on Christmas Eve 2002. That's the point. Still awaiting trial. The jury hasn't even been selected yet. Peterson's attorney, Mark Garagos, told reporters this week that he'd probably watch the movie. He says he's got nothing else to do on Friday nights, but that he'd also probably raise with the judge his concern that it could taint the jury pool. After all, in the film, as in life, it doesn't look good for Peterson.
He runs. He's guilty.
Well, we nail him, the press leaves town.
they love this. Pretty white girl with good teeth, pregnant, Christmas Eve. Perfect. You're going down, Scotty.
USA spokesman John Kelly is quoted as saying, "There is virtually no information in this movie that hasn't appeared in print or on newscasts. We stick to the facts, but there are things done because of time compression." But though the facts may be out there, they were gathered over months. They may taste different when digested in a mere 90 minutes, seasoned by the musings of family members contrived for the movie, or comments of composite pals.
People saw her that morning, Kate.
The police talked to those people.
People saw Lacey, just like Scott said.
They ruled them out, Tommy!
God damn it, Kate! I saw him in the nursery. I helped him put that crib together. He wanted that baby.
Trial consultant Sonia Chopra works out of the Oakland, California office of the National Jury Project, which provides attorneys with research to improve jury selection. She says it's hard for jurists to find the truth when art too much resembles life.
There's something in psychological theory, you know, memory research, that's called source confusion error, and that's when sometimes we see something or hear something and we forget where we saw it. There's been a lot of research done showing that people witness an event, say there was a video, and they'll see a car accident. And then some point later, they will be told, you know, there was a stop sign. When they think back about the movie that they saw, they sometimes remember that the stop sign was there, even though it wasn't there in the movie. They're remembering it because they were told it later. It's the same sort of thing. It's source confusion error.
But USA could argue, in fact, it has argued, that the movie's just a drop in the media bucket with respect to Peterson. What's one movie in a sea of talk shows and speculating pundits that potential jurors have been exposed to over the last year?
I think it's the nature of it, the intimate conversations, the actor who looks strikingly like Scott Peterson. Those are the types of things that are going to stick in people's mind. And then, again, when potential jurors are at trial and they're thinking back to what happened, images from the TV movie could come out in their mind. And then they're trying to think back from 2 months ago, did I hear it this way or was it really this way? Did he go to the marina 3 times or did he go to the marina 1 time?
All this seems to be just another in a new TV innovation called the pre-conviction docudrama, as I've read in the papers. And it used to be that movies came out with surprising speed after a trial, like the one about the Menendez brothers. Mm-hmm. But recently we've seen pre-trial docudramas about the D.C. snipers and Martha Stewart. Mm-hmm. I have to assume that this trend bothers you.
Yes, it does. If I were the defense, I would be more concerned about this movie than about any of the print media or any of the TV coverage, even interviews with the family, because I think we can look at that and say, okay, this is news, this is reporting, the family has this slant on it. This movie is presented as if it's reality.
But they'd say, no, it's not. Everybody knows a movie is a movie is a movie.
I'm not saying that people are so naive as that they're going to think that this is real. You know, they'll tell the judge, yes, I can put it out of my mind. Yes, I'm not going to let it influence me. But it's virtually impossible. And I know of no research that shows that people can truly set aside preconceived biases.
Has the USA Network done anything illegal by airing this TV movie just prior to the trial?
I don't think it's illegal, but I think it's unfortunate. The problem being, of course, that had they waited until even a jury panel was called, not necessarily impaneled, the judge could have given an admonition to the group of, you know, 400 jurors saying, listen, this movie's going to be on, don't watch it. That's not to say that some of them still would, but at least it's something. At this point, there's no way to prevent anybody from watching it. I know of a case in Canada where there was a trial for the Christian Brotherhood in Ontario, and they had a made-for-TV movie coming out. CBC was putting it out, and they effectively blocked it. And in that instance, the prosecution agreed with the defense that it was so damaging that they should delay the airing of the movie until after the trial.
But that wasn't America, Ms. Chopra.
That's right.
Would you be concerned about the First Amendment if you were to file for sort of prior restraint on this thing, blocking it before the trial?
I don't really see how the First Amendment right would necessarily be violated by delaying it a few weeks.
The public has a right to see Dean Cain playing Scott Peterson.
They have a right to see Dean Cain playing Scott Peterson, but they don't have a right to see it tomorrow.
Thanks very much.
You're welcome.
Trial consultant Sonia Chopra works out of the Oakland, California office of the National Jury Project.
This week, India and Pakistan, nuclear neighbors who have fought three wars in the last 50 years, will begin landmark peace talks. When the two countries' leaders, Atal Bihari Vajpayee and Pervez Musharraf, shook hands several weeks ago, it was the first time in 2.5 years. Since that moment, both countries have been ablaze with talks of peace. Amid all the good feelings, one of India's top directors decided to release his much-anticipated film about a bloody skirmish between India and Pakistan. The film is called LOC, which refers to the line of control between the two countries, and it is the biggest Bollywood war film ever. But it seems the timing couldn't have been worse. LOC is a total flop. From New Delhi, Miranda Kennedy takes a look.
When Pakistani soldiers sneaked across the line of control into India's territory 5 years ago, India retaliated with full force. The conflict was one of the worst in the bloody history of South Asia. Thousands of soldiers died fighting in the inhospitable Himalayan mountains of Kashmir, the territory claimed by both India and Pakistan.
That particular conflict was something that nobody really expected.
Shubhra Gupta is film critic for the Indian Express newspaper.
Which is why when it did happen and so many lives were lost, there was this great upsurge of feeling against Pakistan. And I think a lot of signals were given from the establishment that now is the time to talk about Pakistan as the enemy.
The Kargil conflict stirred up extreme emotions in India. Pakistan had done an enormous dishonor to its neighbor, crossed the international border even while the countries were on good terms. Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf was army chief at the time, and India has always held him responsible for the intrusion. To this day, Musharraf denies that his troops crossed the international border.
And now it's all different. In 4 years down the line, it's all, let's make pacificatory noises, let's talk about peace. This is a feel-good time for both the countries.
That may be one reason why Indian filmmaker J.P. Dutta's tribute to the war is a failure at the box office. Some say the film is jingoistic and irresponsible. Other critics call it anti-Muslim and worry that it will cause problems for India's 150 million Muslims. But others say it's just a bad movie. Tushar Dhingra is vice president of marketing for PVR Cinemas, India's most upmarket movie theater chain.
Movie opened very well because the expectation from the movie was huge. It was shot on a very big canvas in terms of the production values, in terms of the star cast involved. It just tanked after that. It started tanking from Sunday onwards. I should not be saying it in the profession I am in. I couldn't sit through it.
Hindi filmgoers are accustomed to long, melodramatic movies, but 4 hours of shooting and swearing proved a little much for most viewers. Director J.P. Dutta, who is refusing all interviews, did his best to faithfully recreate Kargil's month and a half of conflict, and at times it feels like the film lasts that long. Soldiers sing their way into battle in LOC, even at heights of 15,000 feet. Shyam Shroff was the film's biggest distributor in India. He lost big money on LOC, but he defends its 13-minute songs.
Singing, you can't take it out of the Indian movies because otherwise it would be a major problem even for 3 hours for somebody to sit inside. There has to be songs.
But if LOC fulfills some of the criteria of the Bollywood formula by having songs and stars, it breaks the mold in many other ways. Of the film's dozen or so heroes, 10 of them die. Killing off the heroes doesn't usually go down well with audiences in India, where fans have built temples to movie stars and heroes are expected to win against all odds, even if the setting is war. But unlike Hollywood, the Hindi film industry doesn't have much of a track record in war movies. Siam Mishra, a teacher and avid filmgoer, believes this kind of pop patriotic film simply doesn't have a niche in India.
Our Hindi movies are called masala movies. They contain everything, action, passion, romance, all in one. But if it is just war, war and war, it doesn't always give you guarantee of success. He tried to be very truthful, and that is the problem at the box office.
Pakistan's foreign minister recently said that films like LOC should not be made and people should not patronize them. The film is certainly not available in Pakistani theaters. In fact, anyone selling or showing copies of the film in Pakistan is liable to be arrested. And from the way it's being received, it doesn't look like LOC will be seen in Indian theaters much longer either. LOC's washout might just bring a new trend to Hindi cinema, films that root for peace between the nuclear neighbors. For On the Media, I'm Miranda Kennedy in New Delhi.
This week, as lawmakers here invade against the small screen exposure of a woman's breast, Afghani politicians contended with the TV exposure of female faces, singing. For the first time since 1992, and with the encouragement of President Hamid Karzai, Kabul television last month began to air taped performances of women singers, and it has reignited the smoldering conflict between civil rights activists and Islamic fundamentalists. Washington Post reporter Pamela Constable has been following the story from Kabul, and she says the singing women are a potent symbol of where Afghanistan is going and how hard it is to get there.
After the Taliban government fell, there was an initial controversy over whether women could come back at all to television. And that was a battle that was fought, and then basically a compromise was reached. Now there are indeed women on television. There are women newscasters. They do cover their heads and they do cover their arms, but they don't wear veils over their faces. So it's a kind of cultural compromise of sorts.
So what is the essence of this argument? Is this about women on TV or women singing on TV?
The issue of women singing, for various reasons, seems to be much more volatile and controversial. I think it's because female singers here are evocative of a more romantic, perhaps sexually charged kind of culture that is really not kind of safe to express these days, even 2 years after the Taliban have gone. This is a country in which things so subtle that we would miss them, such as how far down the wrist a sleeve is worn and how far down the forehead a veil reaches, makes the difference between what some people consider to be un-Islamic and acceptably Islamic.
So where do the major players in this debate actually stand? Is it the Islamic fundamentalists hate it and the women's rights activists love it, or are there a range of positions in between?
Well, there are. You know, one of the interesting things is that several months ago, there was a controversy about a young Afghan-American woman who appeared in a beauty contest. And somewhat to my surprise, women's activists and women's rights groups here in Afghanistan were upset about this because they feared it would set their own cause back. They are working to reestablish women's rights to work, to attend educational institutions, to express themselves. They feared that having an Afghan-American woman in a beauty contest in a bathing suit would set off such a counter-reaction that it would set back their own cause. Similarly, with the issue of women singers on television, I think a lot of people here in Afghanistan who are more progressive and reform-minded, including women's groups, are trying to keep their eye on the ball and not get distracted by this sort of side issue of whether women can perform as entertainers in the media.
Now, the Karzai government is on record as supporting women's rights and also their presence on television. So where does the issue of singing women stand now?
Well, so far, in spite of the threatening warnings issued by the Supreme Court saying that all such broadcasts should be stopped, they have in fact continued. And every night after the evening news, we see here in Kabul a number of tapes of singers, and usually one or two are of women singing. But it's important to point out that these are not live broadcasts. They're not contemporary. These are very old tapes, of rather conservative, dignified women wearing very protective clothing, singing quite traditional songs. But even so, it seems to arouse the wrath of the real fundamentalists here.
This has become a flashpoint for all of the arguments that are brewing over human rights and civil rights and religious purity in Afghanistan. Where do you see this going?
As long as we're in a campaign electoral season, these issues will continue to be flashpoints. But I think, if I had to guess, I would say that generally speaking, the Afghan public approves of these kinds of entertainment, and over the long run will become used to it again and enjoy it again. It will become part of society.
You talk about an election season in Afghanistan. Of course, we have one here, and we also have an argument over broadcast standards that won't seem to go away. From where you stand, how does Janet Jackson's little problem seem to you?
You know, I'm sorry, Brooke, but I have no idea what you're talking about.
It's been dominating the headlines here. During the halftime show at the Super Bowl, Justin Timberlake reached over and...
Who is Justin Timberlake? I'm in the mountains of Central Asia. Who is Justin? Who are these people?
I really envy you. Pam, it's great talking to you.
Well, it's been my pleasure.
Pamela Constable joined us from Kabul. Her story, Afghan Harmony Hard to Find, appeared in Monday's Washington Post.
That's it for this week's show. On the Media was directed by Katya Rogers and produced by Janine Price, Megan Ryan, and Tony Field. Engineered by Dylan Keefe and Rob Christensen, and edited by Brooke. We had help from Sharon Ball and Derek John. Our webmaster is Amy Pearl.
Arun Roth is our senior producer, and Dean Capello, our executive producer. Bassist composer Ben Allison wrote our theme. You can listen to the program and get free transcripts and MP3 downloads at onthemedia.org and email us at onthemedia@wnyc.org. This is On the Media from NPR. I'm Brooke Gladstone.
And I'm Bob Garfield.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and the William T. Grant Foundation, helping the nation value young people as a resource through research and programs, online at wtgrantfoundation.org. The Charles Stewart Mott Foundation, online at mott.org, supporting efforts to promote a just, equitable and sustainable society, and the National Endowment for the Arts. Support for On the Media comes from the Bydell Foundation, the Ford Foundation, the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, the John and Anna Maria Phillips Foundation, the Overbrook Foundation, and the listeners of WNYC Radio. This is NPR.
You come to the New Yorker Radio Hour for conversations that go deeper with people you really want to hear from, whether it's Bruce Springsteen or Questlove or Olivia Rodrigo, Liz Cheney, or the godfather of artificial intelligence, Jeffrey Hinton, or some of my extraordinarily well-informed colleagues at The New Yorker. So join us every week on The New Yorker Radio Hour, wherever you listen to podcasts.